Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I have admired and been very much influenced by for a very long time is our first guest, I'm pleased to say. He is Dr. Herbert London. These days, he is the president of his own London Center for Policy Research. Welcome to you, Herb London. Great to have you back, sir.
Thank you for your very kind introduction. Always a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
As a serious student of the policy space, Dr. London, I would like to ask you about this shakeup in the security policy firmament here in Washington, announced yesterday by President Trump via tweet, no less, namely that Rex Tillerson is out as Secretary of State and Michael Pompeo, the current CIA director, is his man to replace him. Tell us what you make of this, and is it a good thing?
Well, first of all, I do think it's a good thing. I think that Tillerson and the president really haven't gotten on for a while, as you undoubtedly know, and this was a long time in coming. Everyone in Washington anticipated this decision, so it wasn't a surprise. Pompeo is widely regarded as someone who not only understands the nature of intelligence, but the kind of foreign policy issues that we are now facing. He also has a very congenial relationship with the president of the United States, something that should not be overlooked. I think that Pompeo, by the way, I've talked to people at the CIA, there is no one who dislikes him. Everyone there thinks that this guy is outstanding. So that in itself demonstrates something about his ability to get on with people. Tillerson is a somewhat feisty individual. A lot of things fell into the interstices in the State Department, including a lot of appointments. I mean, we don't have an ambassador in South Korea, which is in some sense almost laughable.
And I was told he was not taking calls from our ambassador in Israel, for example, either, which is another serious shortcoming. Hey, you know, Herb, let me take advantage of the fact that you actually have an extraordinary corporate memory. This reminds me a bit of Ronald Reagan dispensing with the services of his Secretary of State, Al Haig, who, as you may remember, was involved in a similar kind of, well, I believe, sabotaging of the president's policy direction with respect to something called the Siberian gas pipeline back in the day.
And you have a good memory.
The parallels are interesting because what we're being told by Adam Credo at the Washington Free Beacon is the thing that really was the camel back breaking straw was Rex Tillerson's sort of double dealing the president on the Iran deal. Does that sound right, that there's a parallel here, and again, a salutary thing?
Well, I think that it is right, but I think that what you also have to consider is the cumulative effect of so many of the things that Tillerson did. You may recall after the events that took place in Virginia, in Charlottesville, that Tillerson said, well, those are the president's comments. Those aren't my comments. Now, that's an astonishing thing for a Secretary of State to say. After all, we have one president. He speaks for the country. Tillerson does not. I know that the president was very upset when that comment was made. Now, again, what I'm merely suggesting is there wasn't one event. It was a series of events that led to this decision.
No, I think that's right. But this may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. Let me turn to another topic quickly. You've written recently about the president's planned summit with Kim Jong-un. Tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, look, this is a high-wire act. I mean, there's no question. It's a very, very tricky, awkward, and difficult situation. I would guess that every advisor that President Trump spoke to said, don't do it. And the reason why they gave that kind of advice is because they do not want the president to sit in a room with a third-rate or maybe fourth-rate dictator running the most brutal regime on the globe with probably an IQ under room temperature, sitting in the room with the president of the United States as equals. That is certainly something that I understand. It's a victory, in a sense, It's a victory for Kim Jong-un. On the other hand, Trump is not like other presidents. He is willing to engage in acts that other presidents do not engage in. And he's also very firm in his opinions. It's a little bit like Reagan talking to Larry Eagleburger about the Star Wars business. And Eagleburger said, no, Mr. President, you can't include that in the speech. And of course, Reagan goes ahead and does it anyway because he believes that this is the right thing to do. I think that this is exactly what Trump feels. He believes that he knows how to make a deal. He can make a deal. The one thing that I would say, and perhaps the last thing I should say, is if he does make a deal, he should know beforehand exactly what are the contours of this arrangement. If, in fact, we start with the assumption there will be denuclearization in North Korea, and the second assumption there'll be unlimited verification, then I think you go into this and you can negotiate on a whole variety of things. But those two givens have to be part of what starts this. This is not an unconditional talk. This is not a blue sky conversation. This is a very conditional conversation where you know exactly what you want to achieve.
But again, you know as well as I do, Herb London, that when you're dealing with closed totalitarian systems, even the most rigorous of inspection regimes, and we've been promised a number of them over the years, usually fall short in terms of actually being able to ferret out what's going on. And as our old friend Freddie Clay used to say, after verification, what? You know, what do you do when you catch them out? Hey, Herb, lastly, quickly, at the Washington Times last week, you had a very interesting piece about what you call the Russian chessboard, and I think referred to Vladimir Putin as a grand master of the chessboard at the moment. Tell us what you make of the following. We're clearly seeing now threats by the chief of the general staff, no less, to American forces in Syria. If President Trump does, again, what he did previously in response to use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government, we are seeing threats by Russia to the Baltics. They're incessantly threatening NATO. We had this spectacle recently of the president of Russia essentially unveiling this vast new arsenal of nuclear weapons with which to devastate the United States. We're talking about interference in our elections as though that's the end of the world, but it seems to me this is a very small problem, important as it is, but small relative to these others. Talk about the Russian chessboard as you see it.
Well, look, you stated it very well indeed. The Russians, with a very modest investment, are now playing a central role in the Middle East. If you think about it, what the Russians have been able to obtain, they obtained from Obama when he said, look, we can't deal with this this poison gas question. You can deal with it. We delegate this to you. In fact, after Sadat forced the Russians out of the Middle East in 1973, it's astonishing that we have invited them back into the Middle East. And now we're concerned about the role they're playing. Well, the role they're playing is a very clever role in which they use Hezbollah as surrogates and use Iran as a surrogate. The question, however, is if, in fact, Iran becomes far more ambitious in its goals, will the Russians go along with it? Do they want a direct confrontation with the United States? Keep in mind that when they attacked an American brigade just a couple of weeks ago, they got mauled. And again, there were a number of Russians that were killed without very much fanfare or press coverage. It was a remarkable development. It demonstrates something about the strength of the United States in this area when we exercise it. However, the United States is perplexed. After defeating ISIS, the strategy became very unclear. What do we do next? And are we prepared to take on Iran? Iran is on the Israeli border, so we know something about what the Iranians are up to. But it's a question of what the Russians are up to. Netanyahu has gone to see Putin several times in the last few months. And the reason for that is very clear. If we have to attack Hezbollah, we don't want to kill Russians. Keep them out of harm's way. And again, so far, the Russians have been cooperative with Netanyahu. Will that continue? That remains to be seen. And again, there's no question that you have an election that's going on in Russia. Putin is going to win overwhelmingly, but he wants to win with 80 to 90% of the vote. One of the reasons for all of this is this kind of this chest bearing that you see on the world stage is in part for the domestic consumption of Russians. So they believe that we've got a very powerful leader out there. The nationalists love this kind of argument. However, whether in fact it has some sort of realization or manifests itself in any sort of practical way remains to be seen.
We will be watching it closely, the election outcome, among other things, with you, I hope, in the near future. Herb London, and it's great to talk with you. Come back to us again very soon. Herb London of the London Center for Policy Research. Next up, we will speak with Diana West.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Diana West, the best-selling author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, now available, I'm very pleased to say, in a wonderful audiobook narrated by the author herself. So check it out, please, at Amazon. Welcome back, Diana.
Thank you. Wonderful to be back with you.
Well, listen, there's so much to talk about, but let me just start with the interesting developments of the past few days in which President Trump, a man I know you very actively supported during his presidential campaign, seemed to be getting his mojo back. He got rid of Gary Cohn as his economic advisor. He's getting rid of Rex Tillerson as his Secretary of State. He seems to be, once again, putting together people who want to actually make America great again, not sort of pursue at cross purposes with the president, in some cases at least, the globalist agenda from whence they came. Would you talk a little bit about how you see these shakeups and whether it gives you a new sense of confidence that this may well work out?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that these all fall under the category of it's about time. You know, you still wonder how this gathering, this cabinet was actually formed without principals who probably voted for the president. I mean, this is sort of a strange thing that we've watched now for such a long time. But yes, he does seem to be more confident in his own vision. I think that the tariffs presentation or program that he's been laying out, it probably was a formative experience for him. Perhaps he discovered that no one really in his pocket on this, at least in these two very important jobs, were behind him. And perhaps that is what jolted him into this kind of activity. But yes, it does certainly give us a shooting chance to get a team together that will actually support him.
One of the things that is, of course, top of mind for all of us is Russia at the moment. You, after all, have been warning for years, including, of course, in American Betrayal, about the Russians and before them the Soviets' designs on our liberties and republic and security. What are we to make of this seeming now preoccupation by some unlikely allies on the left, primarily, with Russian influence operations and charges of collusion and the like? Is this the beginning of a real course correction on the part of the left, or something that really amounts to very cynical and tactical adjusting of course for political purposes?
The answer is B. Yes, the left here is, I think that we can really look back at this whole period, these past 18 months or more, watching the left build a backfire to continue to try to blow up or burn up the Trump administration, the Trump presidency, with this newfound protestations of concern about Russian influence that have served to deflect and hide and cover up what we can look back as decades of certainly communist influence, Soviet influence, and indeed Russian influence going straight up through the Obama administration and the tenure of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. But it goes back farther, too, going back to the past when we look at the Clinton-Gore administration in the 90s. So this is cynicism that attempts to explain to the American people that Russian influence, that fake news, that all of these terms that we've been living with and breathing over this period of the Trump presidency all began in 2016. And I think that that becomes the way where we can understand that this is not a course correction. This is not an effort to correct past errors, to atone for past sins of collusion, of enablement, of certainly pro-Soviet and absolute vitriol against Cold Warriors who fought the good fight for so long. This is just politics. Maybe not as usual. This is a level of cynicism and deception internally, domestically, on a scale that I'm not sure has been exceeded, because it is not to highlight the facts. It's not to expose the truth. It's to continue to cover it up and confuse people.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, Diana, one of the interesting things is, just as a sort of sanity check, is the focus that is so narrow, as you say, and therefore it raises the suspicion of expediency being at work here rather than a real grasp of the problem. But it's compounded by the seeming indifference of those who are professing such concern about the threats from Russia to the sorts of threats that Vladimir Putin announced in his State of the Russian Federation recently, to blow up the coastlines of the United States, for example. I mean, please, what's going on there?
Well, again, we have to look at this in terms of cover-up and deflection, because when Vladimir Putin trumpeted his hypersonic cruise missile capabilities in that very same address, he was talking about technology that was essentially transferred to him thanks to the Russian reset overseen by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, to a point of specificity that hypersonic transfer was a discussion in an Army report that came out in 2013 expressing concern about the transfer of high technology under this Russian reset program known as Skolkovo, which is the essentially created to be a Russian Silicon Valley outside Moscow. This military use technology drew red flags for the Army back in 2013, and it was a direct product of this flow of technology to Russia that was accompanied by the flow of millions and millions of dollars from various companies involved in this same Skolkovo project into the Clinton Foundation. So notice the stunning silence there that we hear on this in terms of connecting it to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, this very serious and tangible threat that Vladimir Putin is talking about. It comes out of this very collusion, if you will, of the Obama administration. So these are the kinds of hypocrisies that Americans have to understand when they are trying to sift through this disinformation coming from the left and the establishment right.
Amen. Jean, would you talk also about one other issue that you've recently written on at dianawest.net, Diana, and that is ghost stories?
Yes. Well, Ghost Stories was the FBI counterintelligence operation of 10 years duration that was tracking a deeply embedded covert network of Russians who were pretending to be Americans. These are illegals who were here at great expense of the Russian Federation, of Vladimir Putin, and in between Medvedev's government, that were unmasked and rolled up and sent back with great haste under the FBI directorship of Robert Mueller during the Obama years, because the counterintelligence chief at the time said they were getting too close to a sitting cabinet official who is or was Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. This mass quick deportation was completely contrary to all recognized tradecraft in terms of no sufficient time for debriefings, etc. And yet, did we see Robert Mueller come forward and tell the American people there was a terrible threat of Russian influence in the American government?
And not least, we've had all of this called to mind by the man who's just been apparently poisoned by the Russians, one of the spies released in exchange, partial exchange, I should say, for the ghost story perpetrators. Diana West, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today. great talking with you as always, and congratulations on the new audiobook version of American Betrayal. Check it out, folks. Next up, we'll be speaking with Mark Krikorian right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Mark Krikorian, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving U.S. immigration policy. He is the executive director of an indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. You may have caught him last night on Tucker Carlson's program. He is frequently on the air on Fox and other media outlets. We're always delighted when he graces ours. Mark Krikorian, welcome back. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Glad to be here.
Well, you spoke quite forcefully last night about an idea that is being brooded in some Democratic circles, and I just wanted you to reprise it for us. When it comes to the interior enforcement of our immigration laws, there is an agency known as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is his acronym. What is it that is now being recommended by some prominent Democrats should be done about ICE?
Well, a lot of, like you said, prominent mainstream Democrats, not kooky people on the fringe, have called for abolishing ICE. In other words, getting rid of the agency that does immigration enforcement inside the country, not at the borders, but inside the country, and going after, you know, gang members, people who've been ordered deported but then became fugitives, all that stuff, all the interior enforcement, worksite enforcement as well, enforcement against employers that illegally hire illegal aliens, all of those things ICE does. And you know, major Democratic elected officials have called for the abolition of this agency. I mean, you know, what else do you have to do to say that you're for effectively open borders?
Yeah. Well, talk us through how this would work. What are the practical consequences if we've essentially signaled to would-be illegal aliens that as long as they get into the country, as I think you put it last night, they're essentially home free? I mean, I can't imagine a more powerful magnet for more illegal aliens, is there?
No, absolutely. And understand that that is exactly the position that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders took during the presidential campaign. They were pressed on it during one of the debates, and they repeated it. It wasn't just a misstatement or something off the cuff. Hillary Clinton said, no one in the United States who is an illegal immigrant should be deported unless they are convicted of a violent felony, not charged, not a nonviolent felony, convicted of a violent felony. The only people who should ever be deported, everyone else who's an illegal immigrant, if they make it past the Border Patrol, should be able to stay. And, you know, it's an appalling statement.
Yeah, well, bring this home to us, because I think for many, you know, government bureaucracies don't particularly appeal. But from a public safety point of view, as you mentioned, gangbangers, drug traffickers, violent criminal illegal aliens and the like would essentially have the run of the country were this idea actually to, you know, eventuate. You've studied these issues for a long time. It isn't perfect now, even with ICE, you know, trying to do its job. What would it be like should they, in fact, be dispensed with?
Well, this would be an invitation to cartels and gangs, MS-13 and all the other cartels that bring in not just drugs, but are involved in human trafficking and all kinds of other things. And the local cops, of course, would still deal with it, but immigration is one of the most important tools to use against criminals. For instance, if you're in some town in Long Island, for instance, there's a Brentwood, Long Island is a place that has been getting hammered by MS-13. Well, if you're the local police, you know, what do you deal with things like stolen tools and speeders and stuff like that? the FBI maybe could help, but how many things can the FBI do? Whereas if you have immigration as one of the tools in your toolbox, you can grab up gang members that you know are gang members, they're illegal immigrants, you don't have enough hard evidence or enough witnesses willing to testify to lock them up, but you do know they're illegal immigrants. Well, guess what? You round them up, you throw them out of the country. Or if they were illegal and came back, if they're after being deported, that's a felony in itself. Easy to prove. They're standing on the corner. They've become felons automatically. You can lock them up. Immigration is an essential tool for public safety and obviously for national security as well. And getting rid of ICE would get rid of one of the most important tools to protect American communities.
Yeah. Speaking of craziness, the president got into it a bit yesterday in California, Mark, as you know. He was out there inspecting some examples of border wall prototypes, and I want to talk to you about that in a moment. But he took on directly the governor of the state of California, Jerry Brown, said he thought he was doing a terrible job. One of the issues that he's rather irritated with Governor Brown about, of course, is the fact that the governor and his state legislature have explicitly turned their state into a so-called sanctuary state. Jeff Sessions was in the state the week before decrying this and threatening legal action against it. Give us a sense of what's going on with all of that, Mark Krikorian.
California has passed, in particular, three laws that in effect prohibit any local cooperation with federal immigration law, and in fact directly and affirmatively interfere with the federal government's ability to enforce immigration law. And so what the attorney general did last week is not just talk about legal action. He actually filed lawsuits challenging those California laws and calling for them to be enjoined by federal court because they are in fact illegal. There's not much question about it. And so, while the local California District Court and the Ninth Circuit, which is the, kookiest part of the federal judiciary, may well uphold California's laws simply because we're, they're political judges at this point, there's no way it's going to survive in the Supreme Court. So this is the way, finally the administration is directly going after California in the courts, and they're going to win. It's just going to take a while before it happens.
Yeah. Mark, tell us, based on what the president inspected yesterday, is your current reading on what's likely to happen with respect to the border security issue?
Well, the funding bill that the Congress is dealing with now has some money in there that the White House requested for the first stages of building, border walls and or fences and whatever it is that Homeland Security wants. And the Democrats have basically said they're not going to shut the government down over that. So I think the administration is going to get a win in the first step toward building some of these, they're picking one of these prototypes, as you suggested. And you can see if you Google it online, pictures of the six different styles of wall that different builders have suggested. So they're going to get a start on that. Then there'll just be another fight from the Democrats over the next fiscal year, whether they'll give the next batch of money to continue construction.
Well, I think what the president was pushing for, of course, was some sort of trust fund or something that would put the funding in and protect it against either further unfunding or raids on it. Mark, very quickly, let me ask you, also in this so-called omnibus bill that is in the works are reportedly some efforts to effect a sort of amnesty, I assume, for the DACA kids. What are you hearing on that, and what should we be thinking and doing?
Yeah, that's not going to be in there. There have been attempts both in the Senate and the House to sneak in an amnesty for these DACA young people, just as the Senate voted on several weeks ago and failed to do so. So it's almost certainly not going to be in there. And again, the Democrats, having been burned by their previous attempt to shut the government down over amnesty for these illegal immigrants, Democrats are not going to interfere with the bill if it doesn't have amnesty in it.
Mark Krikorian, thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies and for joining us from time to time. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the very near future. Rochelle Peterson joins us next. We'll talk about these Chinese influence operations, the Confucius Institutes on campuses near you, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's with the greatest of pleasure that I welcome as well our next guest, Rochelle Peterson. She is the Director of Research Projects at the National Association of Scholars. She is also a policy advisor for the Heartland Institute and the author of an incredibly important analysis that came out last year entitled Outsource to China, Confucius Institutes and Soft Power in American Higher Education. It's turned out to be the Rosetta Stone, I think, for a lot of us, on a problem that has begun to get, finally, some very serious, high-level attention by the United States government. And I want to salute its author, Rochelle Peterson, and welcome her back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
So remind us, Rochelle, it's been a while since we've talked about this, about what are these Confucius Institutes? Where are they and what are they up to?
These are Chinese government-funded centers that operate on American colleges and universities. They teach students the Chinese government's preferred version of Chinese history and culture. They operate as a kind of propaganda machine for the Chinese Communist Party. And they serve as a way to monitor and pressure American scholars from conducting research on topics that the Chinese government doesn't want highlighted, for instance, human rights violations. So they serve the Chinese government's purposes, and they co-opt American universities into promoting the Chinese government's purposes as well.
That's a particularly insidious piece of this, Rochelle, and you documented it very well in your paper, Outsourced to China. It's not just what those who are employed by the Confucius Institutes are doing, is it? It's what they're also insisting that the campuses on which they operate do or don't do, what the professors teach and don't teach in courses that may have nothing to do with the Confucius Institute. Is that right?
That's right. Many scholars, when I interviewed them, reported to me that they faced immense pressure either directly from the Confucius Institute or from their university administration, who didn't want to offend the Confucius Institute and risk losing this money from China. And
it turns out they're rather easily offended, are they not?
Yes, yes. There is a long track record of China refusing to grant visas to scholars whose work the Chinese government finds offensive. And that's a real risk for American professors on universities with Confucius Institutes. It's an easy way for the Chinese government to watch what they're writing and saying.
And really have a punitive effect on their careers to the extent that they depend upon access to China and research there and so on for their books and teaching. So let me ask you about in the wake of sort of the Trump presidency and a relook at a lot of its inherited, shall we say, policies with respect to China, this seems to be getting some close scrutiny by the federal government. Let's start with what is going on, as best you can tell, in the FBI, Rochelle Peterson.
Well, FBI Director Christopher Wray recently acknowledged that the FBI is in the midst of an investigation of Confucius Institutes for espionage. He testified
to the U.S. Senate in response to questions from Senator Marco Rubio, who was asking about the risks posed by Confucius Institutes. We don't know the details of what the FBI is specifically looking into or where they are in that investigation, but it's very encouraging to know that the FBI is paying attention to this very real risk to our national security and the integrity of our universities.
Well, let me ask you about that risk, because what you just said, and Christopher Wray is the source for this, is not simply influence operations. It's not simply trying to shape the minds of young American presumably future leaders. It's not simply trying to constrain or even punish professors who might be teaching them something that isn't approved, that doesn't reflect the party line, as they say. But you're talking about espionage. Is that something your research has found is a possibility as well?
It's a possibility, yes. I did not particularly investigate the espionage angle, but the FBI certainly is, and FBI Director Christopher Wray testified that he's seeing an increase in China's use of non-traditional collectors of information, and with more than 100 Confucius Institutes across the country, each of which has multiple staff members, there's a good possibility that at least some espionage is taking place.
Yeah, I think it's not just a good possibility. I think it's a virtual certitude, especially since, as you know, Rochelle, one of the things that the Chinese have done for time immemorial is use their nationals as collectors for intelligence. So it isn't necessarily that it would be official spies. It would be simply people who, either because their families are being coerced or because of their own loyalties to the homeland or whatever other reason, they will nonetheless serve as vehicles for collecting information and passing it on to state security organs. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Rochelle, and that is that as you look at these institutes, they fit a larger pattern of an aggressive China on the march and hostile to this country. And I was on a panel at the Conservative Political Action Conference recently with Gordon Chang, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, and he very explicitly called for shutting down these Confucius Institutes and their counterparts, their Confucius classrooms, I think they're called. Talk about the advisability of doing that, not simply monitoring them more closely or trying to buck up these academic institutions to stand up to their pressure.
Closing Confucius Institutes is the number one recommendation from the National Association of Scholars. They are an affront to the integrity of the university. They compromise academic freedom. They compromise American national security, and they give students a false view of China. There is no good reason to keep a Confucius Institute on campus. Colleges and universities should voluntarily close them, and members of Congress should exercise oversight and alert Confucius Institutes in their district, or alert the universities with Confucius Institutes in classrooms, that these are a real risk that they need to look at very, very closely.
Now, I couldn't agree more with that recommendation and appreciate so much your leadership in providing it months and months ago now. But Rochelle, there does seem to be some pickup on these recommendations on the part of the Congress. You mentioned Senator Marco Rubio questioning the FBI director. What else is going on there to try to both caution these academic institutions and actually take steps to shut down these influence operations at best and espionage operations at worst?
Well, there's a lot that's starting to happen behind the scenes. We know that Senator Rubio asked about this in the hearing. He also sent a letter to every university with a Confucius Institute in Florida, urging them to close their institutes. And as a result, one at the University of West Florida is set to close down. A Democrat, Representative Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, has done something similar. He wrote to the Confucius Institutes in his state, urging them to close. And he went further and wrote to every other college and university in the state, warning them against ever opening Confucius Institute. And we're starting to see more members of Congress looking into this, and hopefully we'll see some action, some more action shortly.
Yeah. Is there legislation to this effect that is in the works, can you say?
It's being looked at.
Well, we will be following it closely with your help, Rochelle Peterson. Keep up that good work. I know you will, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, it's a pleasure to say, by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. My professional experience over about 40 years in this town, there are a few people who I can point to who have made more of a difference in more capacities, often unsung for the difference he's made nonetheless, but still an extraordinarily visionary and prodigiously prolific contributor to the public policy, well, debate and policy making of the United States government for decades. These days, he is the executive director of the Congressional Task Force on National and Homeland Security. This caps a series of services in various public posts with congressional commissions, including the Congressional EMP, or Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, as well as the Strategic Posture Commission. He served on the professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee. He was a staff member at the Central Intelligence Agency. The author of a number of important books, including most recently Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Peter Pry, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. So good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Peter, you have continued, I'm happy to say, since you laid down your responsibilities at the EMP Commission, sadly, to write on these issues and to help raise the alarm about them. And I was captured by something you said in a recent piece about what you consider to be the window of vulnerability that we are facing being, I think you put it as acute as ever. Talk a little bit about that, Peter Pry, if you would, in the context of what we're seeing emanating from Russia at the moment.
I think Putin's March 1 speech, where he officially claimed strategic superiority over the United States, is a landmark speech and could be a pivotal point in history because he's telling the truth. You know, Russia has overwhelming advantage in not only the numbers of nuclear weapons it has when you count its tactical nuclear arsenal. It's got at least a 3-to-1 advantage in nuclear weapons, but it's got an enormous technological lead over us because it unlike us, it continued to modernize its nuclear weapons and develop nuclear advanced generation nuclear weapons, super EMP weapons, weapons specialized for clean battlefield use, neutron warheads, X-ray weapons for intercepting ballistic missiles in space, and he described an array of new super weapons in addition to those that that Russia is in the process of developing, the Sarmat, or what we call the Satan II heavy ICBM, that can deliver a payload 10 or 20 times greater than that of Minuteman. And just 30 of these things, if they're armed with the new avant-garde MARV, it's basically it's called a hypersonic reentry vehicle, but it's basically a maneuvering reentry vehicle that would impart cruise missile-type accuracy to ICBM warheads. Just 30 Sarmat heavy ICBMs armed with 15 of these avant-gardes could take out the whole Minuteman force. And it wouldn't necessarily have to do with nuclear weapons because the accuracy is so high. The avant-garde is designed in a non-nuclear mode, too. You could do it with non-nuclear weapons, which is sort of the holy grail of escalation dominance, you know, to be able to conduct a first strike against the adversary's nuclear forces, disarm them, but do it cleanly, with very few civilian casualties and, you know, no nuclear
or very few nuclear fallout consequences and the like. And that is it's the ultimate step on a ladder called escalation dominance that was sort of holy grail pursued by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But we were assiduous in maintaining our numbers and our technology, so they never got there. But Putin claims that he's got there, and I think he's frankly right.
Yeah. Peter Pratt, let me just drill down on something you said there. It's very troubling, and I think probably would be news to most Americans, because after all, we've grown up with successive strategic arms control agreements that have ostensibly enshrined equality between the United States and initially the Soviet Union and subsequently the Russians with respect to the forces of each side. And yet you say there's a 3-to-1 advantage on the part of the Russians. How could that be?
Well, that's because those strategic arms control treaties didn't do anything to limit Russia's tactical, so-called tactical nuclear forces. You know, we dismantled all of our tactical nuclear weapons. These are weapons that are usually associated with shorter range delivery systems. They're meant for the battlefield. But to Russia's neighbors in Europe, they're strategic weapons, you know, because they are under the gun from these tactical nuclear weapons, many of which have yields that are capable of destroying a city, many of which are among this category of advanced generation nuclear weapons that are very usable because they're very low yield. They don't produce any fallout. You can use them on a battlefield just like an extremely powerful conventional weapon. They had, at the height of the Cold War, they had 20,000 of these. And we claim, various arms controllers claim that they've reduced the numbers to 3,000, but we don't know that.
Peter Pratt, let me turn quickly to one of the particular capabilities I think you alluded to there that the Russians have been perfecting over the years as we have been engaged in what I think of as malign neglect of our nuclear deterrent, and that is electromagnetic pulse weapons. You've devoted much of your professional life to understanding this threat and, as I said, warning of it. And yet we have been confronting repeatedly now reports by so-called experts on the subject that this is really not a problem. Most recently in a journal I'd not heard of before, frankly, called Geopolitical Futures. Would you talk about this this fake news, I guess you might call it, or fake analysis and its implications?
Yeah, there's a cottage industry. Ever since the EMP Commission delivered its reports warning about the existential threat from EMP, and we were talking about with a single super EMP weapon, a weapon of special design to make EMP, it could create such extraordinary powerful fields that could paralyze our strategic forces, including our means to communicate with submarines at sea. And theoretically, you could win a nuclear war with just one of these weapons, you know, by paralyzing our strategic forces. And not only does Russia have them, but China has them, and we think North Korea probably has them too. And ever since the EMP Commission, which delivered its definitive reports on this, because the commission was comprised of the free world's foremost experts on EMP, a cottage industry has sort of sprung up, you know, among the far left that hates nuclear weapons and is afraid that the EMP threat would prod us to modernize our nuclear weapons and do things like deploy missile defenses, which the left doesn't want to do, and among the electric power industry that also doesn't want to do anything. And they are producing junk science studies to try to say, oh, the EMP threat isn't so bad. We don't really have to do anything. All of this stuff is just bogus. And unfortunately, and it's written by people who have no expertise whatever in EMP. All of them have never served in any professional capacity working in EMP issues, which involves access to classified information, by the way, in the Department of Defense or intelligence community, or even for defense contractors that do EMP hardening.
Peter Pry, I'm sorry that we are out of time, but I'm so appreciative of your time today, and I look forward to our further visits on these issues. Thank you for the service you continue to render to our country, my friend. Keep it up. come back to us again very soon. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.